puts me back in Manitoba many moons ago.
Gordon Goldsborough is here with another edition of Abandoned Manitoba. But before we get to today's topic, Gordon, I understand you have an announcement.
I do. Back in May, I told our listeners about the nominees for this year's Margaret McWilliams Awards. That's an award for excellence in writing about Manitoba history. Three books have been selected for this year's awards, and so I thought I'd just share with our listeners those award winners, because they're all wonderful books that everyone should read. In the scholarly history category, a book by Yusuf Sufi, I think you interviewed him about that.
I have, yeah.
A book entitled Homegrown Radicals, A Story of State Violence, Islamophobia, and Jihad in the Post-9/11 World. So there's a recommendation for you if you want some summer reading. In the category of popular history, a book by Audrea Land called On the Hunt for William Hallett, Discovering a Forgotten Métis Leader. And what I think it does is it reminds us that not everyone loved Louis Riel, and one of the unfans was William Hallett. And then the third award went for local history to Sabrina Janke and Alex Judge for their book, Portage and Maine, How an Iconic Intersection Shaped Winnipeg's History, Politics, and Urban Life. And, of course, anyone who's walked at that intersection today should have some understanding of how it all came about.
Thank you, Gordon, for that update. And a really nice range of winners. So congratulations to all of them.
Indeed.
So what are we discussing this week?
Well, 4 months ago, we talked about everyday items that were once common, but have since become obsolete. Basically, complete mysteries to most young people. Well, time then didn't permit me to list all of the examples that I had in mind. And afterwards, listeners weighed in with suggestions too. So I thought, well, let's come back to that theme. So today, we're going to mention a few more of those items, starting with a small white plastic bag. It's open on one end, it has a circular hole near the top, and the printing on the bag tells us that it was connected to something called Orbit.
Okay, so what is or was Orbit?
Well, you could be excused for not knowing, because it's been gone a very long time. It was a large, white, spherical container that sat along Manitoba's highways. It was a receptacle for garbage from passing vehicles. Instead of just winding your window down and throwing it out the window, you would collect it in this bag and then deposit it in Orbit. And then right next to the Orbit receptacle was a dispenser where you could get another new empty bag. And remember the hole I mentioned that was in the bag? Well, that hole let you hang it on the cigarette lighter in your car. Now, do you remember when cars actually had cigarette lighters? Well, they did, and that's one place you could hang your bag. Or you could hang it on the window crank. Well, again, you know, instead of just pushing a little button and the window slides down with a motor, you crank the crank. Well, you could hang your Orbit bag there too. So, of course, most modern cars have neither cigarette lighters nor window cranks. And, of course, Orbits themselves disappeared way back in the mid-1980s. But, well, I think a lot of our listeners will remember the Orbit. And, in fact, in my personal collection of ephemera, I do have several Orbit bags. Unused ones, mind you.
You should have brought them in for a little show and tell.
Oh, I know. And I was thinking of that. But, you know, I've had some rearranging in my basement and I just couldn't find them on short notice.
You are forgiven. Okay. So, Gordon, what are some of the items suggested by listeners?
Right. And there were lots of them. So in the realm of clothing, Ray Bernier reminded me of arm cuffs. They're also called sleeve garters. And at first when he mentioned it, I thought, I've never even heard of that. But it turns out I actually have. I've seen them too. In fact, Ray said that his late uncle wore them, and he wore them on the upper sleeves of his shirts. Now, what they were was an elastic circle that had usually a little metal buckle so you could adjust it for size, larger or smaller. And it was used to shorten the sleeves of your shirt when they were too long. They were really popular, and they became popular in the latter half of the 1800s. And if you think about it, and if you've watched like an old movie or even a new movie where they've recreated the past, if you think about the stereotypical bartender, they would have these things around their sleeve. And the idea, of course, was to keep their sleeves out of the drinks when they were pouring them. Or the other one, and this is what I always think of, is a bookkeeper. You think of a bookkeeper, they have two things. They have a little visor, and I never quite understood what the visor was for. And they have these things around their arms sleeves, and those are arm cuffs or sleeve garters.
Well, thank you to listener Ray Bernier for that. What other suggestions did you get from listeners?
From Herb Bjarnason, he sent me an email about drapes. And of course, my first thought was, well, he's talking about window coverings, you know, they cover windows with drapes. But nope, these were pants worn by fashionable young men in the 1950s. And it followed on the zoot suit craze. If you have any kind of recollection of the past or if you watched old movies, you might remember zoot suits, these really over-the-top suits from the 30s, the 40s. Well, drapes were kind of the evolution of zoot suits. They were high-waisted. They ballooned through the thigh. They were often sharply creased on front, and they were wide at the knee but tapered dramatically to the ankle. And if you look at old movies or if you look at any kind of illustrations, say, from the 1950s, yeah, men were wearing drapes. I just never knew they were called that. Another item of men's fashion, and this was remembered by listener Dave White, were spats. If you think of the Monopoly man, you know, the old fellow, he was wearing spats. And they basically were cloth that was worn over shoes and around the ankle by Victorian and Edwardian gentlemen. Sometimes they were made of things other than cloth, sometimes felt or canvas or wool or leather. They were usually light colored, especially if you were wearing formal wear. And that's the Monopoly man. He's wearing a tuxedo and he's wearing spats. Why? Was it just fashion and had no purpose? No. In fact, they were intended to keep your shoes and your socks clean while you were walking on muddy streets.
Kind of like the toe tubbers.
Right. Yeah.
See how I'm making connections?
Absolutely. There's a lot of these things that, you know, back in the day when we didn't have all the nice pavement we have today, you know, you had mud everywhere and you had to kind of prepare for that.
Makes sense. All right. So aside from fashion, what was another major category of obsolete items suggested by listeners?
Technology in the workplace. That was a very common theme among suggestions I heard. And this is one that really resonated with me because for my high school graduation, and I will date myself, that occurred in the late 1970s, my parents were very proud. They bought me a typewriter. Woohoo! Well, of course, I had used a typewriter when I took typing class, and I would note in passing that I was the only boy in a room full of girls. And why? Well, because they were preparing to become secretaries, because that was a woman's job in the 1970s. But my mother insisted, you got to learn how to type. And I did, and I've never regretted it. It's been so helpful through the years. You know, I learned wonderful typing skills, and I, of course, transferred that to a computer. So I didn't use my typewriter very long, I'm afraid, but I do use my keyboard virtually every day, sometimes all day. Of course, personal computers have pretty much wiped out typewriters, because they're just so much better at creating documents. But there were other pieces of obsolete office equipment that were identified by listeners. For example, Muriel Gamey suggested hectographs and mimeographs, and then someone else suggested gestetners. And you think, mimeograph?
Yeah.
Hectograph?
No idea.
Yeah. They were copy machines.
Ah.
You know, before we had photocopiers that make perfect copies, we had these various devices, and really the quality was variable, but not very good. So, you know, it was mainly for making copies in a time when you had no other means to do so. Listener Laurel Sargentson, and she sent me lots of suggestions. One of her suggestions was a piece of cardstock. It was roughly 4 inches high, about 9 inches wide, and on one side it had colored drawings of animals doing human tasks. The one she sent me actually showed monkeys playing golf. On the other side of the front was an advertisement for her father's company called the Portage Mutual Insurance Company. But on the back side, this was the important part, on the back side of this piece of cardstock, there was all sorts of ink blotches of various colors and sizes. It was an ink blotter. And you go, what's an ink blotter? Well, of course, there was a day when pens contained ink, and sometimes you'd actually insert the ink before you started using it, or sometimes you had little cartridges you would put into the pen. And a lot of this ink did not dry immediately. And so therefore, if you just took your letter and you just started folding it, you would immediately smear your ink and it would make a mess. So you would lay this piece of paper on top of the wet ink, and then you had this wooden roller, sort of a half round wooden thing. You'd set it on top of the blotter and rock it back and forth, and the excess ink would be sucked up into the paper. And so when you were done, the ink was now dry. You could fold your letter and send it away without fear of it smearing. Well, the other thing Laurel mentions is that she recalls the day when her father came home from work. He had just witnessed a revolutionary new pen they had at work. It was called a Bic. What it was a disposable pen. In fact, it had a sealed ink cartridge. The ink was such that it dried almost instantly, so you didn't need a blotter anymore. And what was even more surprising is when the ink ran out, you just threw it away and bought a new pen. Pretty much what we do today, if we indeed even use pens.
I still use a fountain pen to write my journal. I insist on it.
Do you use a blotter, too?
I don't. Really,
so you must have to lay it open to let it dry, do you not?
Oh, yeah. By the time I finish writing, it's pretty much dry.
Okay.
But yes, I insist on it.
And of course, new inks probably have some kind of chemical formula that make them dry faster.
Yeah.
But yeah, I still have a fountain pen somewhere. And I remember always that I'd get carried away and I'd turn the page and I'd, darn!
Or you get the ink on your wrist like that.
That's right.
Okay, so were any of the suggested obsolete items still in use today?
Yeah, and there's possible, there's still guys out there wearing sleeve garters. There might be
people. Send pics. Weekend at cbc.ca.
That's right. I can't imagine anybody's using a Gestetner, but who knows? There's somebody out there maybe really loves the old school smell of a Gestetner machine. But anyway, Carol McKibben thought of fly paper. And if you've ever lived somewhere where there are flies, you know how useful it is. It's basically a sticky strip, comes in a little roll, you roll out and pin it to the ceiling, usually in your house or wherever there's flies. And the idea is that flies land on it because it's sticky and they just can't get away. Modern homes, I think, probably have lower numbers of cracks where the flies can creep in, probably fewer sources of open food that would be an incentive to attract flies. But I can speak from personal experience. I teach a class in an old hunting lodge, and there are vast numbers of flies. So fly paper, still very useful. And you can, in fact, buy it, pretty much any place where you can buy hardware or household chemicals. And most people go, what the heck is that for? But it's good stuff. Another household item that is still in use is a chinois. And you might not know what is that. In fact, Laurel Sargentson, who suggested this one, her mother apparently called it a colander, although I'm not quite sure that's the same thing.
Okay.
My mom used one, and I suspect mothers of many of our listeners probably did too. And the idea of a chinois is that it was used to preserve garden produce for later use. It's essentially a cone-shaped fine mesh sieve that sits upright on a metal frame, and it comes with a conical wooden paddle that matches the slope inside this cone. And the idea is that you can move this paddle vigorously around the circumference of the metal cone. And in Laurel's case, you remember her mom putting tomatoes into the chinois, and then when you rounded this thing around, it crushed the tomatoes, and it went through the mesh of the sieve, and then you have had a bowl underneath, it would collect the juice. And so the idea was you were either making tomato juice or tomato sauce. And so that's just a couple of examples of these kitchen things that are still in use. And I bet there's some listeners out there shouting at the radio right now saying, what? He didn't mention whatever. So that's it for now. But if any other suggestions of obsolete items come my way, we will talk about them in a future episode again. So send them to me at Gordon, G-O-R-D-O-N, at mhs.mb.ca.
Really enjoyed that one, Gordon. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm.
So what's coming up for next week?
Well, back in February, I accompanied two friends to a site on the north border of Riding Mountain National Park. They had been skiing in the area and seen a little building that had caught their eye. Now, they know how keen I am about such things, so they invited me to come and take a look. Over the last few months, I have tried to learn about the building, and I think I know most of its story now, so I'm going to share it with our listeners next week.
Thanks, Gordon.
Bye-bye for now.
No matter where I go, everything time the wind blows, puts me back in Manitoba. Many moons.